gamers, agents, real estate. Welcome back to another podcast on the Danico Audio Network. Today, we're talking about some more real estate terms, definitions, and overall scenarios. And so we're going to be talking about the statutory requirements governing the activities of licensees. And so basically, we're going to go over things licensees like myself can and can't do when advertising, talking to clients about commissions, handling contracts, documents, and listings. We're going to go over the disclosure and conflict of interest when it comes to discussing with parties. We're going to go over handling money and trust accounts, record keeping as far as what needs to be done in that department, indictments, closing responsibilities, and a little bit more. And so, hope you guys are having a good day here in the office, and we are ready to get this thing started. And so, let's go ahead and start with the advertising. When it comes to advertising, all advertisements are related to the purchase, sale, exchange, rental, lease, or mortgage of real property or business opportunity by a real estate broker must include the broker's name and the number under which the broker is doing business, the broker's phone number or their street address, and finally, a statement that the person advertising is a real estate broker. Brokers cannot conduct business or advertise under a name that differs from what's on their broker license. If a broker adopts an assumed name, the broker needs to notify the department of the name on the license application within 30 days of name adoption, whichever is the earliest. So as you can see, there are some things that you cannot do if you are, advertising. If you're the broker, you have to have certain things on the advertisement, which is obviously the name under which you're doing business, phone number and street address, like I just said, and also a statement saying that you are a real estate broker. If a licensee is representing a seller under a service provision agreement, the licensee cannot advertise that property as a for sale by owner. That is misleading and gives the public the perception that the seller is not represented by a real estate licensee or is a real estate licensee himself. So you want to be clear, obviously, when stating who the property is for sale by, because some people are going to want to work with real estate agents when it comes to buying and selling, and some people are not. And so, moving on, any licensee selling or leasing their own property must disclose that they are real estate licensees in any advertisements they make. Associate brokers and salespersons must advertise under the supervision and in the name of their employing broker. Groups or teams affiliated with the same broker may also place advertisements. These advertisements must include all the following: broker's phone number and or street address, and the broker's business name in a font size equal to or greater than the individual's licensee's team name or licensee's name. So I'll go over that one more time. Associate brokers and salespersons must advertise under the supervision and in the name of their employing broker. Groups or teams affiliated with the same broker may also place advertisements. These advertisements must include all the following: broker's phone number or street address, and the broker's business name in a font size greater to or equal than the licensee's or team's name. So that's everything when it comes to advertising. We're going to go ahead and move on to commissions and the certain services that we can charge fees for. So a salesperson like myself and an associate broker can only accept commission or real estate related compensation from their employing broker. If a salesperson earned a commission while licensed and an associate If a salesperson earned a commission while licensed and with an associated broker, the broker can still pay that commission to the salesperson, regardless of whether the salesperson is still licensed at the time of payment or is employed by another broker. This question stands out to me, or this stands out to me because it was a question on the real estate exam, basically saying that if you are licensed and then you become unlicensed after you, you know, in the middle of a transaction, you're still able to get paid for that transaction, even though you're not licensed anymore. So fees and commissions or other variable considerations cannot be paid to unlicensed individuals, except as noted above in the case of a formally licensed individual. So this means that a broker cannot pay a referral fee to an unlicensed buyer who gave the broker a lead on a potential seller. Brokers can pay commissions to brokers licensed in other states as long as that non-resident broker does not engage in negotiations for Michigan properties, which would require a Michigan real estate license, so they shouldn't be doing that anyway. The following actions are not perceived as real estate related commissions or participation and can legally be made. The owner or owner's agent can offer existing tenants, and those tenants may accept commission for referring a prospective tenant. The compensation cannot exceed the value of half a month's rent. Licensees receiving commission from a transaction cannot also receive a referral fee or other compensation related to a principal securing a loan for the transaction, unless both buyer and seller provide written consent and the payment doesn't violate the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act or other laws. Licensees receiving commission from a transaction may only receive a referral fee or other compensation related to title, abstracts, title insurance, home warranties, or any other service needed in the course of transaction settlement if written consent is obtained from their own client, and as long as the payment doesn't violate RESPA or other laws. Fees may be charged for a specific real estate related activity. In other words, if the activity requires a license, a fee can be charged for that service. As a reminder, these activities include selling, buying, provided market analysis, listing or negotiating the purchase sale of a property, negotiating the construction of buildings or improvements on real estate, leasing or renting real estate or improvements on real estate, and engaging in property management. So that's everything that we're going to cover when it comes to commissions and certain services that we can charge fees for. Moving on to the disclosure and conflict of interest. This is very important, so make sure you guys pay attention here. If you're an agent, if you're a buyer or seller, you want to pay attention because you don't want your clients, or I'm sorry, you don't want your agent, you know, exposing things to the seller or buyer, whatever side you're on, the opposite in any situation. You know, you don't want them giving, say you're the buyer, you don't want the seller's agent to know what your limit is as far as your price, because then they have some leverage on you. And so first bullet point is licensees must always disclose when there's a potential for a conflict of interest to arise. So right off the bat, if there's even a question that there could be a conflict of interest, then you're supposed to disclose it to all parties right at the front, at the beginning of the transaction and the whole scenario. Michigan law requires the following actions. Licensees who are buying, selling, or leasing real property interests on their own behalf must disclose the fact that they are licensed to the property owner before entering into a purchase agreement. They may receive compensation or other consideration related to the transaction, but again, prior disclosure of license status is required. Licensees who obtain the option to purchase real property from an owner who requested the licensee's services related to the property must disclose the fact that they are licensed to the property owner before entering into an option agreement. And licensees must maintain written proof of the disclosures and consents. The department has the authority to request to see these items and ensure compliance with the law. So in another podcast, I've stated that getting things verbally is okay, but it's not enforceable. And in certain cases, it's not okay at all. And you need to have written consent and, written approval by both parties, all parties involved, to make sure there's compliance with the law. In any advertisements a licensee places, they must also disclose any interest the licensee has in the property. So say you're an owner or a renter, then whenever a client or a customer is coming to show interest in that property, you must disclose up front that you also have interest in that property in whatever medium you do, whether that's equity, you're the landlord, whatever that may be. That's the end of disclosure slash conflict of interest. And, you know, just to sum that up real quick, it's kind of self-explanatory in a way. You know, if you're going to be selling a house and you're going to be working with the buyer and the buyer as the agent for that buyer, then there obviously needs to be some disclosure there saying that, hey, listen, this is my house, okay? I own it full out, and okay? And so just so you know, I am the agent and the seller and the buyer's agent. So it's something that needs to be disclosed because it may cause the buyer to feel a certain way. They may not feel comfortable working with the person directly if that's something they've never done, or they may not feel comfortable negotiating directly because usually two agents would do that. And so disclosure is very important. Next, we have handling of contracts, documents, listings, and recommendations. First bullet point, licensees must provide contract parties with a copy of the service provision agreement at the time of signing. These service agreements must be fully completed by the licensee before any party can sign the agreement. In other words, a licensee can't leave a few items blank, have the party sign the agreement, and then fill in the missing blanks. That's not allowed. A service provision agreement must also include the specific expiration date. A client cannot be required to notify a broker of her intent to cancel an agreement that's going to expire. And automatic renewal clauses are prohibited. Buyers and sellers must receive copies of the signed purchase offers, and a licensee must deliver a copy to the buyer immediately after the buyer signs it. And licensees must promptly deliver all written offers to sellers upon receipt. Delivery can be made in person, by mail, or electronically, and prior agreement from both parties is required to use electronic records and signatures. Upon the offerance and acceptance of all parties, upon offer and acceptance and after all parties have signed the purchase agreement, licensees must promptly deliver copies of the agreement to both parties to the transaction. Licensees must also ensure that all terms and conditions related to the transaction are included in the written agreement. Once a seller has accepted the offer and the agreement is fully executed, the licensee no longer needs to deliver any subsequent offers to the seller unless the service provision agreement between the seller and the licensee states otherwise. That's going to sum up everything when it comes to contract documents, listings, and recommendations. Next, we're going to talk about handling of monies and trust accounts because this is very important. You don't want to get into what we call a commingling situation where you're mixing funds that the buyer or seller gives you with your own funds. That's a no-no, but we'll get into that eventually. If not here, another podcast. But handling of monies and trust accounts. Salespersons must hand over their deposits to their employing broker or any other money related to the real estate transaction upon receipt of it. The law does not provide a specific time frame from which a delivery to the broker must be made. So as soon as you get it, give it to your broker. That's just the best practice. Checks should never be made payable to the salesperson, but instead to the real estate broker. The broker must deposit this money within 2 banking days of receiving notice that all parties have accepted the purchase offer. And if the purchase agreement indicates that someone other than the real estate broker will hold these monies, the check must be delivered to the party who will hold the funds within 2 banking days of contract acceptance. So I'll repeat that one again because that was a bit wordy. if the purchase agreement indicates that someone other than the real estate broker will hold this money, the check must be delivered to the party who will hold the funds within 2 banking days of contract acceptance. So, you know, say you get the deposit or the earnest money deposit on Tuesday, you have till Thursday to, and that being the broker, they have till Thursday to get that, you know, that money where it needs to be. Okay. Next is deposits can only be made into a trust or escrow account that is a non-interest bearing demand deposit account. This money cannot be deposited into a broker's personal or business account. So, sorry, just do not disturb. Brokers can maintain more than one trust account and are permitted to have up to $2,000 of their own money in each account to meet the minimum balance requirements and to pay account fees. But it's vital that brokers properly account for and maintain records of their personal money in these accounts, because like I said, you do not want to get into a commingling situation. Even though that's not really commingling, because you're permitted to have a certain amount in there, you're keeping record, so there's no chance that your money gets mixed up with the client's money. Brokers must maintain these deposit transactions. Brokers must maintain these deposits until transaction consummation or termination and in accordance with the signed purchase agreement. If the disbursement of these funds is disputed, the broker must continue to keep them on deposit until a civil action resolves the dispute and directs payment, and until a civil action resolves the dispute and directs payment to be made, or until parties agree in writing on how to disperse funds. So, you know, a lot of this, well, I won't say a lot of it, but if both parties are able to come to an agreement and that is able to get written down and it's not just verbal, then a lot of the times you can handle these things in a scenario. So, where do we leave off? So, if the disbursement of these funds is disputed, the broker must continue to keep them on deposit until a civil action resolves the dispute and direct payments to be made, or until the parties agree in writing on how to disperse the funds. Checks written from trust accounts must be signed by the broker or an associate broker. Cosigns are allowed, but a broker or associate broker's signature must be included. And now we're going to go on to record keeping. So, when it comes to record keeping, obviously accurate record keeping is essential when dealing with trust funds. Records must be kept in the brokerage office and at a minimum include the following. So that's going to be chronological sequence of deposits and disbursements, the current balance of the account. The deposit records must include the name and the party providing the funds, the receipt and deposit dates, the amounts. And then the disbursement records must include the disbursement date, the person who is getting paid out to, the check number, the reason for the disbursement, and the amount of the disbursement. So records of receipts and disbursements must be tied to a single transaction between a buyer and seller and include the following information: the names of both parties, the property address or legal description, the dates and amounts received, and the dates and amounts dispersed, along with the payee and the check number. All trust, escrow, and transaction-related records must be kept for at least 3 years from the inception date. And finally, when it comes to record keeping, the department has the right to inspect any documents or records to ensure compliance with real estate laws. Licensees are expected to cooperate during normal business hours by allowing the department to access their place of business and to the records the department wishes to see. All right, moving on to in inducements. I still have yet to understand what this word sounds like when coming out of my mouth. Nonetheless, the Michigan Consumer Protection Act, which aims to protect consumers from unfair or deceptive practices, covers inducements. Generally speaking, inducements are incentives. Specifically, the act says the following is unlawful: representing that a customer will receive a rebate, discount, or other benefits as an inducement for entering into a transaction if the benefit is contingent on an event to occur subsequent to the consummation of the transaction. Quick few examples, if you didn't quite get that, would be Curtis tells a prospective buyer that she'll give that buyer a $200 gift receipt if she purchases the home. This is prohibited because, well, do I really need to explain? And then another example would be Marvin holds a drawing for a $200 gift card at an open house. This is acceptable, provided neither winning nor the odds of winning are contingent upon entering a transaction. And so the first one, not good. Second one is okay, as long as he gives that gift card away with no, you know, with no contingencies, with no, hey, take this gift card, but you gotta buy this house. That's not legal. All right, so that's inducements, whatever the word is. No disclosure duty attaches to stigmatized property. So real estate licensees are not required to, nor can legal action be sought for failing to disclose the following stigmatizing facts. So if a former occupant of the property was suspected to be disabled, as defined under the Fair Housing and Civil Rights Laws, the Person with Disability Civil Rights Act defines disability as a physical or mental condition resulting from disease, injury, birth, or functional disorder that substantially limits one or more major life activities and is unrelated to the individual's ability to acquire rent or maintain property. The property was suspected to be the site of a suicide, homicide, or illegal activity, but that didn't affect the material condition of the property. And if a sex offender information that is made publicly in accordance with Megan's Law. So, like I said, real estate licensees are not required to, nor can legal action be sought for failing to do the disclosure of the following stigmatizing facts, and that would be whether or not somebody in that house was disabled in any capacity, whether or not that house was the place of a suicide, homicide, or illegal activity that did not affect the material value of the property, which is important to understand because if it did, then it can be disclosed and needs to. And then if sex offender information that is made publicly available in accordance with Megan's Law. So finally, we have the closing responsibilities. After a buyer and seller have entered into a purchase agreement, their agents are expected, unless this duty has been waived, to assist the parties as necessary through the transaction until complete. Licensees cannot close a transaction based on any terms or conditions that differ from those in the signed purchase agreement unless written approval is provided by both the buyer and the seller. An amendment is generally permitted to provide this type of written approval. So in a situation I have right now, I am using an amendment to add the sale of a couple items to the transaction for one of my clients, and that's just going to amend the original purchase agreement because we didn't include the sale of those items in the other notes. And so since we discussed it after, we're able to use the amendment to throw those in there and get that done, and all of that will be taken care of at closing. Brokers or associate brokers conducting the closing must provide or ensure the buyer and seller are provided with complete and detailed closing statements. These statements must be signed by the broker or associate broker and show all receipts and disbursements affecting the transaction. This responsibility does not fall on the broker or associate broker if a title company, an agent of the title company, or authorized or other authorized licensed party is conducting the closing. And finally, That was it. I had another bullet point there that was not related to the topics completely. And so, you know, we talked about advertising, talked about what services may be charged, what services we can charge fees for as real estate agents, talked about the conflict of interest and what disclosures need to be made between you and multiple parties. We also talked about handling contracts, documents, and recommendations. Talked about handling money in trust accounts. And we also talked about record keeping, indictments, stigmatized properties, and closing responsibilities of agents. If you guys found some value from this episode as an agent, a buyer, or a seller, share the podcast. I'd appreciate it. Like it. Give me a little review. Be honest. I'd appreciate it. And I'll see you guys in the next piece of content released here on the Danico Tart Audio Network. Thank you. Have a great day.